This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Recognize that? It's estimated that globally, people spend more than 3 million hours each day playing Angry Birds. When this figure was first released in 2011, The Atlantic's Alexis Madrigal calculated that if even 5% of that playing happened during work hours, it could add up to $1.5 billion worth of lost productivity. But what if playing a game could actually advance our collective knowledge and benefit humanity? Coming up, we'll talk with a computer scientist who's harnessing the power of the gaming masses to crack some of the toughest problems in science. And he says it could go even further than that.
We are, in a sense, sitting on a vast amount of productivity and increased economic activity, scientific and otherwise.
Also, later this hour, we'll hear from a data analyst who's predicted 35 Nobel Prize winners in the past 12 years and may have a handle on who the winners will be this year.
We're not necessarily saying that the people we pick this year will win this year. We're saying that we assume that they may win this year or in coming years. And so each year we have a new list of citation laureates and people of Nobel class, and that's really what it's all about.
But first, it's gaming for good. Adrian Troy is an assistant professor of computer science and robotics at Carnegie Mellon University, although he's currently spending some time in California at Google X, the web giant super-secret innovation lab that brought us self-driving cars and Google Glass. Troy received a prestigious career award from the National Science Foundation and has been included in MIT Tech Review's Top 35 Innovators Under 35 list. What's all the excitement about? Troy is co-creator of two computer games that are helping scientists tackle some of the most difficult problems in biology. Problems that, if solved, could lead to better biofuels and cures for diseases, from Ebola to cancer. The first game, called Fold It, was released 6 years ago and has resulted in almost as many scientific publications. In 2011, the Fold It community took just 3 weeks to figure out the structure of an enzyme involved in propagation of HIV, a puzzle that had stumped scientists for years. At the head of all this is Adrian Troy, and he joined me by phone from Google X in California. Adrian Troy, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What is it about games, whether it's board games or video games, that so fascinates you?
There's a lot of things. But one of them is the fact that you get to create worlds, actually. You get to sort of create the laws of physics. That's just always been a fascinating thing, both as a scientist and as someone who likes to play games. And then the other aspect of it is that the games are really a window into the sort of a reflection of the human mind and human motivations. And so, as such, they're incredibly powerful instruments. And I think that that can be seen both in the size of the market today, and also in our ability to use them to work with people to solve scientific problems, which is sort of an interesting use of the motivational power of games.
You invented your first game at around the age of 12, as I understand. Can you explain why you did that and what the game was that you created?
Well, I think why I did it was because I had appendicitis, and so I was in a hospital bed. And so I couldn't play around outside. She said that's probably not my first game. Like all kids, I invented Infinity games as a young kid. But I think that it was a card game, and it was exciting, and it was fun. It was fun to make up the rules, and it was fun to create this world that other people would sort of voluntarily go into and play by those rules and see what kinds of outcomes came out. And in a sense, it's very similar to the allure for many people, I think, of working with software and computers, which is to say that there's this sort of perpetual motion to the machine. The computer makes your ideas and your rules come to life, and games are very similar to that. So I think there's a very strong connection there.
When was the first moment that you encountered a scientific problem and thought, this is a really hard problem, maybe we could solve it with a game?
The beginning of that thought was Fold It. And so And the way it was presented to us was the scientists who were working on protein folding, David Baker and his colleagues, basically said, well, look, we have this very, very hard problem, and we have this very hard problem, and we'd like to throw a lot of computers at it, and you guys know how to program computers. Why don't you help us do that? And that sounded like a sort of interesting, okay scientific problem. Not sure if I wanted to work on it. And then he said, actually, in passing, or we could turn the whole thing into a game. And the moment he said that, I knew, I was like, that's what I want to do. And I sort of reoriented my life. I actually decided not to do the postdoc I was going to do at MIT and devoted myself to making that game a reality, and that game turned out to be folded.
What is so hard about the problem of protein folding? I mean, you're starting with a chain of amino acids, these molecular building blocks, and every protein has to fold up in its own way. Why don't we understand how they do that?
So it's really one of the classic problems in biology, and the reason why it's hard to do is because there are simply so many interactions happening, and the physics of all these interactions is mostly but not entirely and completely understood. So you can imagine it's a little bit like saying, why is it hard to assemble a billion-piece puzzle? Well, it's not that we don't necessarily understand how two puzzle pieces come together, but it gets really, really hard when there's a lot of puzzle pieces, and astonishingly, that's what proteins are like in our body. They're very, very complicated. They form these incredibly rich and beautiful shapes, and really those shapes, in the way that they interact with other molecules and other proteins and DNAs and RNAs, is sort of the fundamental, you know, chemical engine of life within ourselves. So it's very important, but there's a lot of complexity down there at that level.
How do you take such a complex problem where normally scientists would have supercomputers trying to work out this problem of how any individual protein would fold, and instead make it simple enough at the level of math and physics that it can actually run on somebody's home computer as a game?
So it turns out that for all the complexity, we can actually, it doesn't take too long to sort of simulate a protein and say, or simulate the energy in a protein and say, does this protein appear to have a good energy state or not? So it's an interesting question. So we can basically use computers to evaluate proteins quickly, but it's very difficult to use computers to actually find the right answer. And similarly, if I gave you a huge puzzle, you could look at it and instantly tell me whether it was made or not. But that doesn't mean that it's simple to put together. And so so that allows us to create a game. So basically what the computer does is it's constantly evaluating what the human's doing and helping the human understand, is the protein well folded or not? But then the human has this much sort of deeper and even more creative, you might say, task of trying to figure out how to put the puzzle. In this case, it's a complicated 3D puzzle with weird rules and stuff, but how to put this 3D puzzle together.
You've been comparing this problem to a puzzle, and that seems slightly different to me than something like a board game or a video game. There's not necessarily the same sorts of rules to follow in order to solve a puzzle. So is this really more akin to a game, or is this more of a puzzle or maybe a toy?
I think it's a sort of combination of all of these things. So in the strictest sense of the word puzzle, it is a puzzle in the sense that you're trying to find the right answer. And I mean, that's sort of one of the unique properties of science, is that there are these right answers out there, and it's really exciting if you can find them. And so in that sense, all of science is a puzzle, and folded is a reflection of that. But we borrowed a lot of ideas from game design, and in fact, even from toys, in designing folded, and I think that that's part of its success. So one of the goals of a toy is that it should be sort of fun to play with, and the ways that you can play with it should be manifest just by picking it up. So that's sort of the key thing you want a toy to have. And indeed, in Folded, we tried to make the proteins which are these very exotic molecules, we tried to make them toy-like. So we didn't want the user to go through all this boring explanation of, you know, this and that law of physics and how it applies to protein folding. Instead, we wanted to just give them this 3D object that they could poke and pull, and as they did, they could see how it reacted and slowly start to build an instinct, if you will, or a model in their mind of how proteins behave.
Now, you've since created a second game, Eterna, that instead of figuring out how to fold proteins from chains of amino acids, you're figuring out how to fold RNA molecules. Again, these long biomolecules that need to fold up into different shapes to actually perform their function in the cell. Is it a coincidence that both of these games are centered around folding problems?
So I should say that RNA is, the second game, Eterna, is not based around trying to figure out how RNAs fold in the same way that folded is. So the goal in Eterna is to design new RNAs, and rather than take existing proteins and see how they fold. And the major innovation in Eterna is that we actually synthesize many of the molecules that players design. So actually, to your point earlier about how does the computer know whether or not a protein is well-folded, in Eterna, there's no computer. Instead, we actually perform the experiment, and then we give players scores based on what the experimental results are. So
people are literally creating an idea, essentially a hypothesis on the computer, and you're actually going into the lab and synthesizing that molecule.
Exactly. And so that's incredibly exciting because, first of all, the players are very excited about it, and they get to do real science, essentially. But second of all, by basing the game on experimental reality, we get around any kinds of problems which may sort of exist latently in the computer models. The computer simulation may be wrong, and if that's the case, then the whole game is moot. And in Eterna, that's impossible because the underlying game is coming from experimental data that we're continuously running.
With Foldit, there have been some high-profile successes. And with Eterna, there's been kind of an interesting evolution that at first, the molecules that players were creating were not very successful. But within a few months, the humans were coming up with better solutions than computers. Why is the human brain suited to actually answer these hard questions better than a supercomputer?
The key is that computers, for all their brute force, sometimes have mistakes like programmed into them. And those mistakes may be software bugs, but in this case, they're more likely to be sort of slight inaccuracies in the model. And the really sort of one of the core things that the humans can do is take in all this new information and incorporate that into your understanding of the world, and ideally do so sort of creatively. It's really a remarkable fact, actually, but what the Eterna community was able to do was identify areas where the computer programs were wrong and then out-design them.
Explain that. What do you mean? How do they out-design the computer?
Well, suppose that you design an RNA to fold into some particular shape, and the computer says, oh, yeah, well, this looks like it's going to work based on my model of reality, but that model has some inaccuracies in it. Well, the players can say, look, we've been running experiments on these kinds of RNAs for, you know, a couple months now, and we know that this isn't going to work because we've tried these kinds of things before. So what we're going to do is tweak the RNA in this way that we've seen work before, and we're going to see whether that works. And so the remarkable thing is that, I mean, this is real science. This is really trying to build new hypotheses based on new experimental data. And it's being successfully carried out by a network of tens of thousands of people working together on the Internet.
How much training do those people need to be able to tackle these very difficult scientific questions?
Well, the games are designed to require no training whatsoever, so other than basic literacy. So the typical path that we find for the elite players is that they join the community and they're intrigued and they play the game, and you know, often they get sort of obsessed with the game and play it a great deal. And then slowly, as you rise to the community, you become surrounded by more and more players who have been playing the game for a long time, first of all, and second of all, been thinking a lot about the science. And at a certain point, you can't get really good at the game without learning a whole bunch of science yourself. And so it's really this process where, you know, you learn by doing, and you get thrown into this community of people who are competing to play this scientifically based game, and you learn science almost as a byproduct of trying to win the game. So it's very, very different from the way most people learn science, that's for sure.
You are changing, in a sense, the whole way that science is done, from having a small number of highly credentialed people locked away in academia, banging away at these problems, to making the process of knowledge creation, invention, innovation, something that everyone can participate in. That could be a very powerful thing. Is there a danger at all in doing this?
Well, no, I think there's no danger at all in giving people increased economic or increased intellectual or economic opportunity by sort of making new kinds of activities or new ways of contributing to the society open to them. And I don't think there's any danger in sort of greater dissemination of scientific knowledge and exploring new ways of presenting it and teaching it to people and having them do useful work. So I think I'm really excited about it.
That's Adrian Troy, co-creator of Foldit and Eterna, two online games that are helping scientists figure out problems in biology that even supercomputers haven't managed to solve. We'll continue our conversation and dive into an Eterna training game after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll return to our conversation with Adrian Troy in a few minutes. While Adrian says there's no training necessary to play his games, that's not entirely true. Eterna, the game where you get to design new RNA molecules for researchers to study, that game was designed with a tutorial. But there was a problem.
They had a huge attrition rate. So for everybody that came and tried their hand at Eterna, the vast majority, 90%+, would just try it for a minute or two and then go away because it wasn't really clear in their tutorial what it was about, how the science worked, why am I doing this, you know, and even how do I get good at it.
That's David Condon, editorial director for Nova Labs. His team has worked with Eterna to develop a new introductory game called RNA Lab. Full disclosure here, Nova Labs is an online citizen science team associated with the TV show Nova, which is produced by my employer, WGBH. With that out in the open, let's experience RNA Lab with its developer, Alex Rosenthal.
If we could predict exactly what shape any RNA sequence will fold into, we could harness RNA's power. For example, we might design an RNA that turns off cancer-causing genes. Scientists have tried to use computers to solve this problem, but they haven't had much luck due to the sheer number of possible combinations. And that's where you come in. You can do something that computers cannot. Find the patterns that rule RNA design.
The game starts with that. That's the video intro. And it's a video that explains what RNA is, what its relationship to DNA is, and why you should care about it, essentially. What you can do if you understand RNA and understand how it folds up. So RNA is primarily taught as messenger RNA, which is the intermediary between DNA and proteins. As it turns out, RNA does a whole lot of other things, and that's part of what this project was built around. The mRNAs are basically strands of code. RNA also has the ability to fold up into shapes, and those shapes determine its function. And they're folding up in complex three-dimensional ways. We come at it late in the game where we know that RNAs can do certain things. They can deactivate genes in DNA that do things like cause cancer. They can fight viruses. And really, there's a wealth of functional RNAs. And we know that. But what we don't know are how can you create a certain shape of the RNA? Even if you know that, you know, an RNA has to look like this to do something, how can you design the RNA in such a way that it will naturally fold into that shape and then carry out that function in a cell or in a test tube environment? So the goal of the game is about designing RNA in exactly that way. And once you get good enough at it, you can actually start to discern what those invisible rules are.
Let's play.
So let trial one begin. So what's going to come up here, this is a two-dimensional representation of a transfer RNA.
It looks a little like a pearl necklace dropped on a table.
If you unfolded it, if you squashed it down, this is what it would look like. And each of these circles represents one of the bases that makes up RNA. And there are four bases. They're A, U, G, and C. And so there's text instructions that help guide you and explain what you're doing. In this case, GCs are the strongest connections. You will need to put them at the weakest points in the molecule, like girders that hold up a building. The weakest point of most molecules are the ends of stacks. A great way to start puzzles is to paint GC bonds at the ends of stacks. Try that here. So this down here is our palette that we use to paint RNAs, and it has the four bases, and then you can also paint with pairs of bases at once. And so the critical one of the more critical things to understand about RNAs is that what makes them fold up into specific shapes is these four bases will bond to each other in very specific ways. So G and C make a strong bond with each other, A and U make a medium bond with each other, and U and G make a weak bond with each other. And these bonds are basically hydrogen bonds between atoms. But when enough of them can bond to each other, it makes this strand. So normally an unbonded RNA would just looks like a strand of beads, basically, just a linear strand. But what we want to make it is this shape. And then the shape translates to a three-dimensional form that, in this case, can pick up an amino acid and facilitate building proteins. So we want to use these GC bonds at the ends of stacks. Stacks are the lines of bases that we want to bond together, whereas loops are the unbonded bases. So we did that. Good. Now paint strong bonds onto the rest of the stacks. Remember, you can check if a molecule is not folding correctly by switching to natural mode. So we can just click and drag over it, and click and drag, click and drag. You get little fireworks and bubbles that tell you you've completed the puzzle. And then, so now we translate this design that you've made into an actual functional RNA, which you drag into the cell, and then you see it picking up its amino acid, bringing it to the ribosome. So after each of the puzzles, once you get to this point, you actually see your RNA in action carrying out its function. And so in that way, we marry form to function, which is really the central idea of this molecular biology game, that in the cell, as with proteins and as with a lot of things, the form translates into function, and that's what creates the amazing diversity of functions and molecules that are able to keep us alive. So there's a once you've created that tRNA, then you're given instructions to make another tRNA. I just skipped over that moment, and then you're fed it back into another puzzle. And then in each of these puzzles, you learn a little more about the strategies you need to solve the puzzles, which start out fairly simple, but then get to a level of complexity. But we found that pretty much anyone, we've tested with 8-year-old children who can do this and ranging, as far up as you want. And really anyone can pick this up. And you learn what you need to know to create these molecules. So again, we bonding stacks together, and we have a shape guide that tells us how this RNA will fold up, and we can also switch between this shows us what the shape we want to make, and this is what will actually happen if we paint it that way. So we switch back and forth between those, and we use those as clues to solve the puzzle.
With these puzzles, we're utilizing the fact that these are RNAs that are well understood, that we know how they'll fold up if you paint them a certain way, in order to teach people how it works. So that's why we can know. We say, okay, you've painted, you've designed this RNA, you've painted the bonds, however you've painted them. Here's how it would actually fold up, because scientists know how that would fold up if you actually created it in the lab. Of course, that's different from the lab portion of Eterna, where they don't know actually how it would fold. So,
I mean, as a learning tool, mm-hmm. this sounds great, but how many levels do you have to get through before you're actually doing something that is novel scientifically?
So in order to get to the point where you're participating in the actual lab portion of Eterna, you play through the 24 puzzles in our lab, which can take anywhere from an hour to a few hours, depending on your how quickly you pick it up. And then that gives you 5,000 points in Eterna. And in order to participate in the lab, you have to get 10,000 points. So it gets you halfway there to actually participating directly in the science.
Let's go back to Eterna creator Adrian Troy now. Once you're in Eterna, one of the unique things is an emphasis on competition and rewards. Adrian Troy, how would you win at Eterna?
Well, you win by getting a high score, like in so many games. And then if you get play over and over again, your score accumulates, and pretty soon you become famous and people respect you in the game and so on and so forth. So, you know, we really took a lot of the basic same motivational principles that you would find in an ordinary game and simply married them with a totally different type of puzzle, i.e. science. And then the rest, you know, the rest is history.
I think that's really different from the typical crowdsourcing model for science, where the emphasis is on collaboration rather than competition.
Well, so I wouldn't want to give the impression that there's a huge amount of collaboration in the games. And in fact, first of all, people are willing, in addition to the competition, so people form teams. We've even seen teams where they're organized, that they all live in different time zones, so that the team can continue working when the sun's up in some team member's time zone. And people who are good at different parts of the games. We've also, you know, for example, the opening, the mid-game, the end-game. We've also seen just a lot of spontaneous collaboration occur among the players. So helping one another edit Wikipedia entries and helping one another analyze experimental data in the case of Eterna. And so, you know, it's actually like science itself. You do want some competition because that keeps the engine moving quickly, but you also want it to sort of happen within a collegial atmosphere. And we've tried really hard to create communities that sort of struck the right balance in that way.
Are there certain scientific questions that are more amenable to becoming a game like this?
Yeah, definitely. So interestingly, there is a tension between science and game design in some ways, and in other ways there's not. So for example, if you were just designing an ordinary game, let's say Mario, as the game designer, you could say, "Well, I want Mario to jump a little bit higher, or else this game will not be fun." And so the game designer gets to change the laws of physics. And really, when you're designing these kinds of scientific games, obviously you can't change the laws of physics. That's the whole point. The whole point is that you're playing with something real, and it has to follow the real laws of physics, or else science isn't being done. So to me, that's actually a really deep and fun challenge, which is you're given this strange, you know, object that behaves in this weird way. How do you build a game out of it that people care about when you don't get to change any of the rules because they're ordained by nature? There is a tension there, but I find it to be a lot of fun. On the other hand, there's many ways in which science and game design are completely complementary. And one of the most interesting is that when we were doing early play testing for these games, we found that most of our attempts to sort of sublimate the science in the name of game design, people actually didn't like that, and they liked to know, for example, the real scientific term for something, not a made-up game-like term that we invented. So ironically, the more science you put into the game, the more people wanted to play it. And we didn't realize that that was going to happen at all. But it's very, very cool and interesting.
A lot of getting this to work is also getting the right people, the right community. How do you go about essentially designing or fostering the right community to play these games and build successes?
We do what sort of any, you know, community-based startup, you might say, would do, which is that we work really hard, especially initially in the games, to sort of set the tone for the community. And, you know, the Internet's a wild place, so sometimes you have people who are disruptive to the community and they have to be kicked out. And other times people do really wonderful things to the community and they need to be encouraged. And so we spend a lot of time on the, you know, really surprisingly very, very human aspect of this. And of course, one of the wild things about this this kind of scientific research is that it puts you in, you know, practically direct contact with tens of thousands of people who are all sort of working on the, on this project that you've given them. And so there's this very, very interesting, very fuzzy sort of human aspect to it. I should say now that the communities are established enough in these games that they're essentially self-perpetuating, and so much of the work of sort of maintaining standards and collegiality, or much of the thanks for the work, should go to the players themselves, who I think have basically taken on the banner of this kind of scientific research and really, really poured their lives, their hearts and lives into it in some cases. And so it's a joy to see, but also I should acknowledge that they're doing a lot of the work, not just us.
You have said publicly before that whoever owns a network like this, a crowd like this, owns something very valuable. Do you feel that you own this, and is there an economic value to it?
I certainly don't own it and don't feel like I own it. The projects were all done in a university setting, and they're all explicitly not for profit. And I think that that's part of the allure and part of the fun. And we, you know, we didn't do any of it for profit. I looked at it much more like we were taking these beautiful, beautiful puzzles out of the academy, and we were packaging them and handing them back to the world. and the world was, you know, gifting them to the world, and the world was really excited about it. But that said, in both of these games, there have been really spectacular and real scientific outcomes that I'm very proud of. And so, you know, science is usually a harbinger of things to come, sometimes decades in advance. But I think that there's, you know, one would have to conclude that economic activity is happening here. And I think that if we were to take these same kinds of techniques and apply them to less sort of abstruse scientific problems, there's totally a level of economic activity here which could be beneficially, you know, exploited.
The game Minecraft was recently bought by Microsoft for $2.5 billion. It seemed kind of an exorbitant price tag to some. Did that surprise you? And do you think that your games could ever have that kind of economic value?
Well, nothing surprises me in this crazy world of tech acquisitions these days. So I don't know how they come up with these valuations, but my hat goes off to the Minecraft people. They clearly created something of enormous value in the sense that people who played their games, it was really a world that people were willing to devote, you know, thousands and thousands of hours to, and so it engaged really deeply a large number of people. And I think that that's admirable in a way. It certainly is very difficult to do. I think what those people were doing was probably less useful than folding proteins or designing RNAs. And so I hope, in a sense, that what we are doing with our games will ultimately prove to be much more valuable.
That's Adrian Troy, co-creator of the online science games Fold It and Eterna. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll get Adrian's take on how games like this could change not only science, but our economic and political landscapes, too. And with Nobel Prize announcements just around the corner, we'll check in with a data analyst who has predicted 35 Nobel laureates in the past 12 years. Stay with us. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with computer scientist Adrian Troy. His online games Fold It and Eterna are advancing a new model for tackling some of the most difficult problems in science. But he says it doesn't have to stop there. On the economic side, you've said that crowdsourcing provides almost an alternative to the corporation model that is the centerpiece of our current economic system. Could you see crowdsourcing, gaming, and this whole online realm completely changing the way our economic system works as well as the scientific system?
Yeah, and I think that we are already seeing that. So, you know, platforms like Amazon Mechanical Turk allow people to get paid to do very small and often pretty trivial tasks. And so on the one hand, you look at this and you say, oh, well, this is some sort of dystopian future where, we spend 9 hours a day clicking on cats and images. But on the other hand, I look at it more as though we've figured out how to connect crowdsourcing and money and tasks that people need done in this one very simple way. And now our job as computer scientists is to figure out more interesting and rich ways in which labor can be performed over the internet remotely without many of the constraints that make it difficult for people to have access to work typically. So I think it's always beneficial to have more options for how to contribute, and I think that crowdsourcing is certainly adding to those options, and I think that's just the beginning of the story, absolutely.
Do you think crowdsourced gaming could contribute to other societal issues, say something like climate change or perhaps even the Ebola outbreak that's going on right now? Are there ways that a crowdsourced community could contribute to these problems?
Well, it turns out that Ebola is an RNA virus. So we should get Eterna players working on this immediately. So, yes.
But in the short term, in terms of perhaps brainstorming or coming up with new types of responses or policies for coping with these kinds of challenges.
Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of scope to do just exactly what you just said. You know, many of the players who are sort of world famous within these games and very, very respected by the community are not scientists, and they have the BBC did a documentary on one who is an administrative assistant. So in a sense, by playing these games, they've been able to unlock a sort of potential to contribute to society much, much richer than what was offered to them by the existing corporate structure. And if we imagine that that phenomenon could be replicated across many people, then potentially we are, in a sense, sitting on a vast amount of productivity and increased economic activity, scientific and otherwise, which is essentially latent. Basically, you're not likely to have the best possible job that you could, simply because of you probably do because you have a wonderful job, but
I
many
do.
People don't have the most optimal job that they could have for themselves because the accident of their life never really put them in contact with that job. And I think one of the most sort of exciting possibilities for these games is that they provide beacons on the internet for people to learn about different kinds of ways of contributing to society, different kinds of problems that they can solve, and in fact bring a great deal more efficiency to the market of how should you spend your time every day in a way that benefits the world.
To me, it seems in some ways like you are reframing all of what science is. But there's a very, I think, set stereotype of what it means to be a scientist, and that's not terribly appealing to many high schoolers or college students. But what you're saying is work on really interesting, really hard puzzles, compete, and at the same time serve humanity. You're essentially describing science, but in a completely different set of terms.
Well, I appreciate. I'm very flattered by that statement. I guess I would say that many of the stereotypes of science that I encountered growing up, and in fact, I didn't want to be a scientist for just those reasons, have turned out to be completely false when I actually started doing science. And I think that, the best science is is people who are working on hard problems and who are passionate about them and who think that those problems are important for society. And in that sense, you'll find exactly the same spirit among great people in any field, you know, great entrepreneurs and business people and statisticians and doctors and so on and so forth. And I think that if a young person wanted to contribute to the world in a really exciting way and solve hard problems and be surrounded by other people who feel that way about the world, then science would be an excellent way to do so.
You are currently spending a stint at Google X, Google's relatively secretive innovation lab. It's the place where self-driving cars and Google Glass were created. Can you tell us anything about what it is you're working on right now?
I actually cannot, but I'm working on combining human and computer intelligence in interesting ways. And so, you know, very not totally dissimilar from Eterna and Foldit in that we were looking at problems where we felt that the human mind could sort of significantly help computers in a way that they were not performing optimally.
Well, Adrian Troy, thank you.
Thank you.
I wouldn't be at all surprised to see Adrian Troy's name in the running for a Nobel Prize in future years. In the meantime, we're looking forward to the 2014 Nobel Prize announcements next week. And today, we're getting a sneak peek at some of the researchers who may well receive one of those life-changing early morning phone calls. Each year, data analysts at the Intellectual Property and Science branch of Thomson Reuters attempt to beat the Nobel Prize Committee to the punchline by predicting who will take home the prizes in medicine, chemistry, physics, and economics. Joining me now by phone to explain how those predictions are made and who's in the running this year is Thomson Reuters analyst David Pendlebury. David, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you very much.
First of all, why try to predict the Nobel Prizes? Why not just wait until next week?
We're attempting to illustrate how the use of a quantitative analysis of the scientific literature can tell us something very interesting about science, how talent and achievement in science is incredibly skewed. There are relatively few people that are in a position to be nominated for a Nobel Prize or who may, in fact, win a Nobel Prize. This quantitative analysis, based upon how often researchers' papers are cited, can point us to this very small group of elite researchers who may be in the running for a Nobel Prize. This ability to determine through citations which research has had significant impact is also an aid in doing research itself, in being able to discriminate against one paper versus another. So there are several reasons to investigate this, to see how quantitative indicators of scientific performance correlate with various prizes and other measures of peer esteem.
Since 2002, you have accurately predicted 35 Nobel Prize winners. 2011 and 2013 were particularly good years with correct predictions in all four categories. So has the algorithm been that you use been changing over time? Has it been improved?
No, we follow the same procedure year on year. And that procedure is to search our large database, which is called the Web of Science, in which we index some 12,000 research journals worldwide. They're published worldwide. And we're looking for these rare papers that are cited at extremely high frequency. We've indexed, for the period 1900 to present, more than 58 million articles. And it's a very small group of papers that are cited in any at any time from publication, 1,000 times or more, just 15,000 of those. So we're talking about a fraction, a small fraction of 1%.
Does that mean that the scientific community as a whole is disproportionately focused on 1% of researchers, on 1% of studies that have been published? And do you think that suggests a dysfunction?
No, I think in many ways it's just the way the world works in terms of human selection and judgment. People come to the conclusion that some things are better than other things, and that scale is logarithmic, in fact. a Nobel Prize winner may be able to accomplish 100 or 1,000 times more than the so-called average researcher. Of course, you have to look at this distribution on a field-by-field basis and do so in terms of the ages of the researchers, but talent and achievement in science is certainly not normally distributed.
There are certainly other factors that the Nobel Prize Committee can take into account besides how many times the scientific community is drawing on a particular person's research when they're deciding who gets a Nobel Prize. When your predictions have missed, have there been factors you could point to explain the discrepancy between what you're finding in terms of the citation of a paper, how many times it's been drawn on by other researchers, and what they consider to be some of the most important and most influential research?
Well, I don't think that the Nobel committees or the Academy pay that much attention to citation counts. I think they are engaged in traditional peer review. We are using a quantitative method to try to arrive at the same destination. But in fact, the quantitative method is indeed a form of peer review. It's just a massive form of peer review. The citation record tells us what research has been influential or significant to publishing scientists. So it's no surprise that there's some correlation between people with extremely highly cited papers or total number of citations to their work over a long period of time, and the fact that they tend to be also the people who receive top prizes, such as the Nobel Prize.
Do you attach any sort of probability or certainty to the predictions that you make?
No. And that's a good point. What we're trying to do is identify people of Nobel class. So when you think about the millions of scientists publishing and that only 200 or 300 people are nominated, that's a very small group. And we would say that quantitatively, through the use of citation analysis, we're trying to identify that same group, people who would have some probability of being nominated. But the number of Nobel Prizes given each year in each prize category is a maximum of 3, according to Nobel's will. Therefore, that's a difference of 1 to 100 of people who will actually win. So when somebody wins the Nobel Prize that we have previously called a Thomson Reuters Citation Laureate on the basis of their publication and citation record, it's surprising. It's surprising because of those odds.
David, are you a betting man? Would you ever put money on any of your predictions to win a Nobel Prize?
Only last year when there was the prize in physics and we suggested that Englert and Higgs would win for the discovery of the Higgs boson. But one didn't need citation data to indicate that that was a safe bet. That was widely expected without this quantitative analysis.
You can find a full list of the Thomson Reuters 2014 Nobel Prize predictions, plus a link to information about past Thomson Reuters laureates and Nobel laureates on our website, capeandislands.org. David Pendlebury, thanks.
Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.